40 minutes of gold. Here we go. Hi, everybody. It's the Week of the Tackle podcast, the podcast where we look back at the previous week in football and or soccer, delete as you like, and tackle the topics that we thought were interesting. I'm Tom Rennie. Alongside me is a man in super holiday mode with the Apple MLS season on hiatus until next year, still hungover from Columbus Crew's astounding victory in MLS Cup, and still very much pale having sat next to Tim Horsey and thereby not seen natural sunlight for several days. It is Mr. Brian Dunny Dunseth. How are you, mate? You all right?
I'm fantastic, Rennie. Are you ready? Are you ready for not only the Christmas spirit that I know that you just have bursting from the seams from inside of you with your children and your wife and what the holiday gifting spirit means, and at the same time recognizing that you're about to be driven into the ground with the amount of games and the amount of work that you have scheduled for yourself, you big old numpty?
I know, because other people, so I am on a kind of staff contract at TalkSport, so I'm contractually obliged to deliver these games, and other people, I'll get in touch with them and say, oh, do you want to come and do a game on Boxing Day, the 26th for me? And they say, no, I have a wife and children and a family. Of course I'm not going to do that, you f***ing idiot. Sorry, Tim. And so I'm overseeing the day as well as doing a commentary on Boxing Day. I've also got various production and presenting duties across the next like 2 weeks. To be fair, like obviously when you work every day over a period of time, I think you are entitled to whinge about it. I think it's okay to have a little moan about it. But upon reflection, I've done like 11 years of these. It's actually super fun. Like it's a really, and when you see people at games or I see people in the studio, it's always that sort of, I see people on the road on Boxing Day. You know that great Chris Rea song, Driving Home for Christmas? It's a little bit like that. It's a big hit in England and Europe. And there's a song, Chris Rea talks about driving home for Christmas and getting to see all those lovely faces. It's the same for me. It's like driving to work on Boxing Day. Everyone here's either staff or their wife has left them. That's basically what it's like for me. So it's just me and the single dads in central London on the day. Anyways, that's all coming up. I'm looking forward to it. But there's loads of stuff going on right now in the football world. And we've got about 40 minutes to rattle through what's happening. I do want to get your view on the current and next Club World Cup. The Champions League draw happened. And unsurprisingly, by design, the matchups were sorry, Tim. That's two. So we'll get into that. And I would like to talk a little bit about the fact Nottingham Forest have changed their manager and Mohamed Kudus is pretty good. Plus, we'll talk a bit about Tom Lockyer's cardiac arrest if there's time as well, because there's just so much to get through. And I'd love to see what Dunny thinks about that. But the weird thing about this particular recording is that we'd sort of planned to talk a bit about Liverpool against Manchester United. I always think of it, Dunny, from a kind of sales of the Premier League perspective, which, you know, another part of my sort of role, is I always think of it as our classic or our classico or our classica. It's our two most successful teams. If this was, you know, in Spain, it'd get billed as a classico. If it was in Germany, it would be classico. If it was in to another country, France, it would be Le Classique. If it was in that's enough.
What about Italy? Give me Italy. You got it in Italy.
Classico.
I felt good recovery.
Yeah, that good felt offensive. Recovery. It felt offensive. I'm moving on. But it was a bit more like, remember Red Monday a few years ago? I mean, were you expecting a thriller? Everyone seemed to say 4-0, and we thought there'd be a few goals in it. What went right? What went wrong?
Well, I think there's two very different perspectives, right? First off, let's just go with the football fan. Eyeball test. There's only one team on the field. Eyeball test, visual markers. Who's got the ball? What are you doing with the ball? The style, the substance, the identity, the movement off the ball, the creativity in the final third, all of that stuff, eyeball test, 100% in favor of Liverpool. Now, there is an art defensively, and being a former center back myself, I mean, it's kind of like the Chiellini and Bonucci, kind of like high fives when they stuff somebody in the transition, all that stuff, club and country. There is a beauty in the art of defending, and tactically, the beauty of the art of defending is keeping the game in front of you, making it difficult for the opponent to break down. But there were moments there were moments where the initial line of contention defensively was Hoyland about 15 to 20 yards outside of his penalty area. That's the highest player on the field for you. And I get it. You got injuries, you got suspensions, blah, 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 blah. You're trying to make sure that there's no recreation of the 7-0 drubbing that we saw a year ago at Anfield. I will say, Liverpool fans, Keith Costigan is your jinx. Every time that Keith Costigan leaves the United States, goes to Anfield to watch Liverpool, specifically against Manchester United over the years, Liverpool doesn't win. So I'm just saying, Keith Costigan might be the jinx. So
yes.
Thank you.
As many people have said before, let's ban Keith Costigan from England.
Yeah, makes total sense. So that's the eyeball test, right? The visual markers. When you're just watching a game, who do you enjoy? Yeah. I certainly did not enjoy Manchester United's
You didn't enjoy it? I thought you might have enjoyed that. There was a lot of Dan Sethery going on.
No, but again, defensively, I think there's pride in performance. And I would say more than anything, it was a character building game. I don't know how much you need to be having character building moments 17 matches into the season, but with everything that has gone horrifically wrong, and what was it, 12 losses and 23 matches heading into this game, still 12 losses and 24 matches, that's less than ideal, far, far, far from ideal. And I think the problem for me, if I roll back even a week further, is this narrative. The Glazers are unimportant in this conversation. Sir Jim Ratcliffe is unimportant in this conversation. Richard Arnold is unimportant in this conversation. I'm just talking about what can the manager do with the players that he wanted to bring in? How does he make them better? How does he continue to develop young players, which bring in Pelistri, Hannibal? I thought Mainu was really, really good. Garnacho was indifferent. Scott McTominay, every time he puts on the shirt, I can never fault him because he leaves it all that, like, that's one guy you know that understands what it means to play for Manchester United. And he's never going to be less than a six. He's not going to be a 10, but he's never going to be less than a six. So putting that all in perspective, my problem still with Erik ten Hag is, when asked by Jaap Stam, when are we going to see you play the style of football that you played at Ajax? For him to say, I can't play that style at Manchester United, while is probably his truth and his honesty, it's really nerve-wracking for a United fan to hear that you are going to sacrifice the thing that got you through the door to interview for the job to be Manchester United manager was because of how you played at Ajax, was because how you developed the players, but because you went into Champions League football and you were pinging the ball around against opponents that shouldn't be close to being chasing shadows the way they were. Because my argument would then be, well, Ange Postecoglou losing Harry Kane, how can he have that style of football that's so eyeball pleasing, right? So the reality is that there's three managers right now that have a distinctive style of play. It's Pep Guardiola, it's Jurgen Klopp, and it's Mikel Arteta. Ange Postecoglou, it's too early for the litmus test. But those are the three. Everybody else is trying to catch up, right? We're talking about big, big clubs. Now, Unai Emery, De Serbi, 100%. You can probably name a couple others if you want, but just like that are successful in real time, smaller clubs. In reality, Aston Villa is a massive, massive club and Brighton's making their mark. But I just, when I watched this game, Manchester United was playing not to lose, and that's fine. Mm. It's fine, but it's also an indictment of where they are in reality. And for Roy Keane to get fired up, historically, I understand where he's coming from with basically talking about the arrogance of Virgil van Dijk, but Virgil van Dijk was right. Virgil van Dijk was right. Manchester United was not playing to win the game. Now, tactically, keep the game in front of them. Maybe we can nick a point. I mean, Garnacho chance, Højlund chance in particular. So I get all that. There were chances for them. But that's, I mean, we're about to turn in 2024. That's not the style of play that I, as a Manchester United fan, I would rather go down swinging with my head held high as opposed to, yeah, we're terrible right now. Let's just cling on for dear life and try to keep all 10 players behind the ball at all times.
I mean, I was quite impressed by Man United, I've got to say. I think we all expected so little of them that maybe, you know, we expected nothing in this game because of where Liverpool are, where Man United are. And, you know, they have got heavy injuries to key players in key positions. So to go there and not get beat against a team who have won every single game and scored multiple goals, I just think it was pretty impressive. And I do sort of think that it was a very praiseworthy performance. And his point, I think it's really interesting you raised that about the Ajax thing. It's a bit like, you know, I'm seeing Nuno Espirito Santo coming into Nottingham Forest, and he won the league in Saudi before Benzema came in. And I remember watching Nuno Espirito Santo at Wolves and certainly at Tottenham, thinking, "God, it's a very negative, try and get the point sort of manager, but done a good job." But when he went out to Saudi Arabia and he had the biggest budget and the lot best players, they won the league and played good football. When Erik ten Hag was at Ajax, at that point in time, it wasn't the current PSV who have gone 16 for 16. There was no real competition. So, of course, when you're playing Zwolle or Twente or whatever at home, of course you can be expansive because they've got Billy from the estate and Johnny Klogulike on the wings, right? They've got nobody. And I suppose you can't come over him and just impress yourself, can you, in that way?
So, but for me, it's not about... I hear what you're saying. It wasn't about the Eredivisie performances. It wasn't. It was about Champions League performances. It was about how he made all of those players better. Now, again, I know the spotlight's different. I know the pressure.
Tomane's got better.
Mainu's got better.
Garnacho's got better.
Palistri's got better. Hannibal's gotten better. So
Maguire's got better this season.
Yeah.
Luke Shaw's playing the best football of his career.
Well, hold on. Is Maguire gotten better? Is Maguire gotten to play?
Just wait to see what you said to Maguire, to be honest.
I mean, Varane looked pretty good the other night. What's different about his performance? Oh, he got to play. Luke Shaw, I've never understood the hate on Luke Shaw. I think Luke Shaw is I think he is incredibly important for Manchester United when he's on the field. Yeah. I get it's more about the style of play. It's different nowadays.
You can do it. If you're winning the league, you can play like that. Unless if you're sitting in seventh, you can't.
That's it.
You've got to win 30 games of 30. If you do that, do what you want. If you win 20, it's not good enough. Let me ask you a question on my theory on Ten Hag, because I do want to move us on to some things that actually happened this weekend as opposed to this drab 0-0. My theory is that he's going to do a bit of a Unai Emery. And he is probably going to, at the end of this season, it'll be handshakes all round. They finished sixth or seventh. It was all fine, but it wasn't great. And we're going to go a different direction. And then he'll go maybe to Holland or he'll go to Spain. He'll do reasonably well, you know, Europa League run or something like that. And then he'll come back to England, an Everton or a Villa or someone in that second tier like Unai Emery has done. You could even say West Ham for what David Moyes has done there, right? Come back and we'll be like, oh, actually, maybe he's just a bit more in this league of a... not the favourite manager. He could definitely punch above his weight as opposed to punch his weight at Man United. What do you think about that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you put Erik ten Hag at one of, quote-unquote, the smaller clubs, what would it look like? Listen, De Zerbi and what he's doing at Brighton, could he do it at Manchester United? Here's two examples. You brought up Nuno Espirito Santo, who looks like he's going to be named Nottingham Forest head coach. What does Steve Cooper do with a better team? Nuno went from Wolves, was named manager of the month at Tottenham and sacked a couple months later. Graham Potter was like the bee's knees of next English manager. He got Chelsea and everything went wrong. Oddly enough, he's recently been linked with Manchester United.
Make it happen, football gods. Please do this for us.
Mauricio Pochettino.
Yeah.
I mean, what the success he had with Tottenham. You're inevitably going to win something with PSG because, I mean, the team can roll itself out. But he comes back to Chelsea. I mean, I don't know how to even verbalize what it looks like so far after 17 matches. So I get your point. I could totally see it happening. But this is... how do I say this? How do I figure out the narrative of this? You can be prickly... like Pep, like Jurgen, like Arteta. But you also have to be, emotionally inspiring. And I don't know if there's a presence that we've seen publicly from Erik ten Hag that is there to inspire the masses. You know, like, because Ange Postecoglou comes in, I'll just use a reference point because it was the way he was verbalizing. It was his presence, but it was after they lost to Chelsea and they went down. And just that sentence of, we could go down to six and still have a crack, mate. Like, that was like, that's my fucking guy right there. That's my fucking manager. Sorry, Tim. Like, those, like, okay, the equity, sweat equity, like, ride or die, I got you. I don't know how... if you take away being analytical about the situation, right? If you just say like tactics, okay, this is what's happening. Let's talk about the Glazers. Let's talk about Sir Jim Ratcliffe. Let's talk about the manager. Let's talk about the transfers. Let's talk about the spend. Let's talk about, you know, the dynamic of the young players. Let's talk about the crop of players. Let's talk about who we want. Like if you can get away with that, can you look at Erik ten Hag and say, "Ooh, yeah, that's the man. Like that's the guy." I don't know. That's a tough argument to make in favor of him, like having the same, and not all managers have to be the same in no way, shape, or form. But you got to have a little something, right? Mm. You got to have a little something special, a little special sauce. And
you're not seeing it. You're not tasting it.
No. I mean, I do, but like,
it don't taste good. He's tasting it, but it don't taste good.
Swishing it in my mouth right now.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. What I learned from American Pie is look first, drink later. I want to move us on to someone who has got that special sauce, and that is David Moyes. I went to West Ham Wolves at the weekend, and I want to raise this with you because you know it's gonna boil my piss, and so I thought you might enjoy this. It was a really good performance from West Ham United, probably the best performance of the season. The first half, where they actually tried to attack a game, got confident, found spaces, counter-attacked in a way they used to do a couple of years ago when our friend Jesse Lingard was there. It was terrific. In the second half, it was just typical Moyesian. We've won it now, so let's not do any further risks and score on the counter. It's frustrating for me, but you know they won the game 3-0. And as the Ten Hag conversation went, if you win the game, you achieve your objective, you got everything right. And I'm a firm believer in that. Mohamed Kudus, just so good. Ridiculously good footballer, and he has settled so quickly. I've been really surprised by it, especially considering the current manager, you know, will normally give you a year. Look at what we're getting from Lucas Paqueta now. We weren't getting that for 10 months. It took the last 2 months of last season and now to see some of the kind of good through balls that we've seen. He really was poor for quite some time.
There's only a manager that knew Kudus before he got to Premier League.
There was no one. Anthony was better. Everyone knows this.
There's only a manager that.
But what? I mean, this is what annoyed me, right? Is that as soon as he scored the second goal, and you're watching this guy, and he's got that Wilfried Zaha thing that I used to love about Wilfried Zaha. Four players around him, you kind of still feel like he's going to get out of this, then he does, which is great. He's got more of an eye for goal than Wilfried Zaha, I think, ever had. Not to disrespect the double figure season Zaha had, but
yeah.
Saw the goal, it was like, he's going to score this. Three goals in a week, two in this game. What annoyed me was, I have a lot of friends and colleagues who work out in Ghana. A friend of mine, Rahman Osman, journalist, is immediately tweeting, if he keeps playing like this, won't be at West Ham for long. And I was thinking, Rahman, who is a big like pro-Chelsea man because of the links there. And I was thinking to myself, if Real Madrid come in, right, fine, I understand that, and a lot of the attraction I think for Mohamed Kudus going to West Ham is that he'll do 2 or 3 years and hopefully have a four times the value move, like that is in everyone's plans. It's why Lucas Paqueta's got a release clause of 85 million reportedly that comes in after the second year, so right, that's capitalism, that's fine. I don't think it was the dream of Mohamed Kudus to play for West Ham, but I also look at it and I think you're talking about like, oh, we might get this move to Chelsea had a success because they were being bankrolled by essentially Vladimir Putin allowing Roman Abramovich to earn, right? That's the reason Chelsea had success, because they were pumping dirty oligarch money into the Premier League. It isn't because they are particularly, oh, look at that pedigree of success. In the 90s, they were relegation battlers under Glenn Hoddle, were Chelsea. So look, I appreciate that they're a upper mid-table team, but let's not compare them to like Man United until the oil money came in, right? That's what happened. And now they don't have it. Now they're spending money, but they're not spending wisely. And the money spent needs to be recouped in some way. So Chelsea have all sorts of issues. So look, I get Real Madrid coming, fine. But he's obviously angling for, oh, we could make the move to Chelsea. And I thought, well, at this point in history, is a move from West Ham to Chelsea, bearing in mind that, you know, West Ham had 3 years in Europe. Chelsea aren't in Europe. West Ham have essentially doubled the size stadium that Chelsea do. You're playing in front of 62, nearly going to be 66,000 fans at some point soon. Why is that something we have to talk about immediately? You know, why do we have to be like, oh, he's so good, he could play for somewhere else? West Ham right now are an upwardly mobile, spending good money, signing good players, winning European trophies, qualifying for European competition team. And if a Champions League or title favourite come in, I'm willing to have that conversation. As long as the money's good, that's what it's for. but it becomes like, oh, he's so good, he could play for Chelsea. And I just sort of thought, what? Mm. He's not, if he, a step to, from West Ham to Chelsea in this current environment is a step down for a player. Mm. And I don't see where the appeal is in that move. And also why we have to kind of, why are we talking about it? He's playing for a great club in front of a huge crowd, one of the biggest crowds in European football. And at the moment, I just can't imagine him being at a better place. Oh, he could go and replace Salah at Liverpool. He could do, potentially. Sure. Mm. But why are you going to talk about that? You've already got Salah, you why don't you enjoy that? And we can like have some fun here for a little while. You know, it annoys me.
I got to be honest with you. I didn't have December 19th on my bingo card when Tom Rennie was going to be sensitivo about West Ham players. But now at least I know we've got a watermark. Let's mark that, Tim Horsey. December 19th, 9:04 Mountain Time. We're talking about West Ham player. Listen, let me give you a different take. While I understand your frustration and I get where you're coming from, what if, and just hear me out. Mohamed Kudus finishes the season. You guys qualify for Europe. You make another great run in Europe. And at the end of the day, you bankroll him, just like you did with Declan Rice. Now, what West Ham have done, when you're talking about Kudus, you're talking about Edson Alvarez, you're talking about James Ward-Prowse in particular, those three. We're not talking about Paqueta being the next to leave, right? So take him out of the equation for a second. If you can turn that money into three more players that are gigantic impact starting players that 100% makes your team better, then, I mean, think about the foundation that Declan Rice inadvertently has created for you. So I get, listen, we come from different backgrounds. We come from different, you know, team supporting. You are ride and die. You don't give a flying squirrel about anything else in West Ham. I totally get it. And I actually, to a certain extent, like I do feel for you, because anytime that you guys do well, anytime that an individual player does well, the inevitable link to a quote unquote bigger club is going to be there until you guys lock in that number 5-6 position within that top 5-6 in the Premier League. But in the meantime, man, business acumen wise, what you guys just did last summer, I actually don't think it's a bad thing. If you can be a selling club while still qualifying for Europe in the short term, the long-term plan within the next 5 to 10 years should be cementing ourselves as a top four team. You're in London, beautiful stadium, incredible history with the club. I mean, short-term, that must really piss you off. I'm just thinking long-term for you guys. Mm. Like the future is so incredibly bright. Obviously, the next manager is going to be a really, really, really important appointment. But you got a really good team right now.
Mm. I don't think there'll be a next manager, personally. I'd be stunned if he didn't resign.
He's never going to leave.
In March, he will sign a two-year contract. And again, 19th of December, mark that down. In March, David Moyes will sign a new two-year contract to remain West Ham manager. And frankly, if they're in the quarterfinals of the Europa League, they've made the final of the Carabao Cup or, you know, the quarterfinals already and are in the top seven, I'm not sure they're going to do a great deal better. So we'll see where it is. The proof will be in the current pudding. But all I'm saying is, just drop it for 18 months, okay? Like, Tottenham fans had 7 years of it. West Ham had 3 years of it. Like, we understand. We're fine with it. But can we not talk? He scores a goal. He looks so good doing that for Liverpool. He scores a goal. Oh, it'd be so good doing that for Real Madrid. He looks f***ing great in claret and blue. All right? Sorry, Tim. Calm yourself down. Right. I want to move on to another story that I thought was brilliant, Danny, and I thought of you immediately when I watched the game on Sunday. Emi Martinez and Neil Mopay.
Oh, my God.
This incredible moment in the game between Brentford and Villa. Now, let me just read you this, because this game kicked off at the end. Ben Mee gets sent off in the 71st minute. From that point, Thomas Frank, his manager, gets a yellow card in the 72nd minute. Then Leon Bailey gets a yellow card in the 80th minute. There's then a yellow card for Ezri Konsa and Saman Ghoddos, both in the 86th minute. Then John Duran gets a yellow in the 87th minute. Then Vitaly Yano gets a yellow in the 89th minute. Then Frank the Tank Onyeka gets a yellow card in the 90th minute. Then Neil Mopay gets a yellow card in the 91st minute. Then Boubacar Kamara gets a red card in the 97th minute. Emi Martinez and Yarmolenko get yellow cards in the 98th minute. And then Unai Emery, to cap it off, gets a yellow card in the 98th minute. Top brawling from these two teams. And I'll tell you again, the little commentator secret is that we have to tell you contractually and responsibly that we don't like these kind of things. But I think they're pretty great, to be honest.
I love it. We fucking love it. Sorry, Tim.
So good. I want people swinging in. I want windmills. I want 30 seconds of like lifting your shirt up, hockey style.
Hold me back. Timmy Tough Nuts. Hold me back.
But Emi Martinez, I know you love Emi Martinez. For those that didn't see it, briefly, Neil Mope at 1-1 runs near Emi Martinez, who then jumps on the ground like he's been clotheslined, Vladimir Soufal style, and then goes on the ground like he's hurt. Mope, who himself is also a dick, sorry, Tim, kind of whinges about it. A little bit later, it happens in reverse, though at this point, Brentford are 2-1 down and chasing the game. So why Mope does it? Just purely instinct. He then goes to the ground pretending to be pushed over by Emi Martinez, and that leads to the brawl. Emi Martinez, just the king of Dunsethery, is he not?
Oh, so there's only one other goalkeeper in the world that can compete with Emi Martinez, and that's Tigres goalkeeper and fellow Argentine Nahuel Guzman. And they were just in the final. I'm going to take you quickly from England to Mexico. Liga MX final, second leg at Azteca Stadium. It's Tigres against Club America. Nahuel Guzman. Now, this is the same Nahuel Guzman that did the mime during the penalty kick in Vancouver. He's the one that, as they beat LAFC, somebody threw a beer at him and he caught the beer and looked at it and started laughing like, I got you. So he gets a red card. They go to extra time, 30 minutes extra time. He gets a red card. The cameras... Sorry, I was so excited about this. The cameras literally pan through the net of the goal, and literally Nahuel Guzman has a tarp over his head. He's like this. You can see his gloves, and he's staring at watching the game. Like, he's thinking nobody else could see him, as he literally had his gloves still on with the tarp over his eyes like this. And like, basically he's like this, like where the signboards are, he's like this, watching the game. It was fucking amazing. Sorry, Tim. So Emi Martinez is the only other goalkeeper that I can compare to the Ishousery, the Dunsethery, if you will. Even when it was, what, a year ago, 2 days ago, when he got his golden glove and he did the in front of whoever that guy was standing on the stage, pretty rich guy. With Mope, that's the same guy that effectively got Guendouzi kicked out of Arsenal. Remember when Mope was at Brighton, Guendouzi lost his top. When Mope hit, was it Bernd Leno at the time?
Yes.
And Guendouzi lost it. Oh, you don't know how much money I make, all that stuff. That was the catalyst, or at least the final straw, for him being sent out of Arsenal by Mikel Arteta. So there's a history here. Here's the thing that bugs me, and I love Dunsethery. I cannot stand. And you can suss them out really quickly if you watch. I can't stand the guys that act like they're the toughest guys on the field, and they'll come through and they're like, and they'll push back and like, hold me back, like, pushing and hold me back, hold me, like, you better hold me back, bro. Like, you're not going to throw a punch. Like, what are you doing here? So the only thing they'll say is, much like Casemiro, who was it against? It was against Palace.
Oh, Crystal Palace. It was Will Hughes. He strangles Will Hughes.
Yeah, he caught him. Like, Kamara, like, just kind of knuckle throated him for a second. You know, hands to the neck, all this stuff. I just, what I will say is, Aston Villa Brentforded Brentford at home.
Yeah.
They outhoused Brentford, sorry, Tim, in their own tactics, in their own home. Even for Ollie Watkins, after he scores that goal, I love it. Give it back to the guy that's been taunting you the entire game, even though historically you were amazing for Brentford. I loved every single second of it. Had no problems with it.
Just on the Watkins thing as well, for those that haven't seen it, he scores a goal, points directly at one person, then like screams woo repeatedly in their face and says this one guy was giving me grief the entire game. And like, there's been all these sort of like think pieces, like these po-faced pink think pieces in the paper being like, oh, you know, you should be able to give it to the crowd if someone's like barracking you. I'll tell you who doesn't disagree with that. The crowd. The crowd don't disagree with that. The crowd would love the pantomime element of it. The crowd love it when you acknowledge them and talk to them and respond to the taunt. This guy probably loves that. He's gone down the pub afterwards. He's had a couple of pints. He's like, you see Watkins sharing that, me? You know, sorry, Tim. You're terrific. This is like, no fan is going to be like, oh, you shouldn't have done that. Like, don't go into the crowd and Kung Fu Cantona them. Like, fine. But I think the crowd and this guy, if we ever find him, probably won't. But if we did, you know, I just don't think they'd have a problem with it. So you haven't got to defend the crowd. The crowd, the amorphous blob that is, know what they're doing. We're waiting for confirmation on this as we record the programme, but it all seems pretty set in stone about Nottingham Forest. Steve Cooper sacked as manager. Looks like Nuno Espirito Santo of Wolves, Tottenham, and Al, whoever the f***. He has been sacked, confirmed. He has gone. Sorry, Tim, by the way. Is going to come in to replace him, old Nuno. The Steve Cooper thing is interesting, Danny. I love your view on the fact that I was chatting to a Nottingham Forest fan friend of mine not too long ago. And I was like, oh, Steve Cooper, what a nightmare. Like, the season's been terrible. They've lost 5 of the last 6. They've only won 2 away games since coming up to the Premier League. At the moment, it's 1 point in the last 5. They're literally sitting above the Luton, Burnley, Sheffield United group, and they're single-handedly making it seem like one of them three could survive in the league. And he said to me that Steve Cooper is probably the most popular Nottingham Forest manager since Brian Clough,
yeah,
who famously won the European Cup on 2 occasions. So, you know, pretty high standards. I'm one of the greatest ever managers, certainly in the history of English football. His great quote, I wouldn't say I was the best manager, but I'm certainly in the top one. And there are many others. I just love that one. It's on the side of the wall at the City Ground. After the Fulham spanking of a couple of weeks ago, he was like roundly cheered by the support, Steve Cooper. It was the same night the owner, Malinakis, threw his pass into a bush because he was so furious and just like luzzed it somewhere on his way out of Craven Cottage. What do you make to this? The fact that he is so popular with the fan base, whatever happens with Nuno, he ain't going to be as popular coming in. But if it wasn't Steve Cooper, this form, I think, probably would have got him sacked a long time ago. What do you make of this?
Well, a couple things. I would say, one, we have to acknowledge Steve Cooper did something that, what was it, the better part of 18, 19, 20 some years wasn't at the club. And that was, he delivered Premier League football back to Nottingham Forest. Well established, my buddy Dane Murphy was a part of that group with Steve Cooper that got promotion at Nottingham Forest. And then everything changed significantly. You know, the team that was built based on young, dynamic talent and a lot of loan deals of Premier League players, I think potential Premier League players. Once you made that move into the Premier League, that team was significantly different. And what was it, like 17 players over the summer, and by the start of the Premier League season, it was somewhere hovering between 21 and 22 players inside the locker room. So the start of the season, it's a brand new team. It's not the team that got them promoted. Nowhere close to the team that got him promoted, with the exception of one or two important pieces. So fast forward, you have a very rich owner. You have a very blustery owner. You have a very emotional owner with a really big background in the game. But it's got some baggage along with it. So whoever... the start of the season, it's got to fall. The axe falls on a couple different people. Inevitably, it ends with Dane leaving as well. Steve Cooper gets a new deal. They stay up. Incredible storyline. But this is a really bad promotion year for championship teams. Sheffield, United, Burnley, Luton Town, they're really struggling. So realistically, how much under threat is Nottingham Forest to relegation? 5 points clear as it stands right now. Based on form and results, it's a result-oriented business. I can understand if you chose to sack a manager. But this one feels a little bit different. And I wonder, with all the havoc with the creation of how the club is being run, including the owner, I wonder if anybody in real time said, okay, hold on for a second. Hold on for a second. Let's think this out. Let's not be emotional. Let's be calculated with this. Because I just wonder if we're going to be talking about this in a couple months' time, that the team is no better than it already is. You have sacked what is widely regarded as a legend at Nottingham Forest and for what he's done for the club, and who is most certainly going to get another Premier League job. Anytime a job's going to open up in the Premier League, Steve Cooper's name is going to be attached to it immediately because of how good of a coach he is, how good of a manager he is. And listen, I respected the job that Nuno Espirito Santo did at Wolves, but there's nothing incredibly celebratory about what we've seen from Tottenham or in Saudi Arabia. I mean, a good manager, but Tottenham didn't work out well. The perception that it was Benzema or Nuno in Saudi Arabia, and it was always going to be Benzema. So I don't know what this looks like. I don't know what it feels like, but all I'll suggest is that when you sack a guy that's so beloved by the fan base, you know who they're going to turn their anger towards next? It'll be Nuno to an extent. It's going to be Marinakis. He's going to be the guy. He's going to be the one that all of that frustration, if results don't change, that they're going to say, it's your fault. Why did you do this? What were you thinking? We're not anywhere close to being better than what we were under Steve Cooper.
And another reason for his legendary status, to build on your point, is they were bottom of the championship when he took over, got them in the Premier League and kept them in the Premier League. So good luck, Nuno. I want to move on to the Club World Cup. I'd love your view on this. Now, the current one is going on as we speak. We're recording whilst Man United, Man City are facing, what are they called again? Urawa Red Diamonds, which I love because it sounds like the next Rolling Stones album. And it's the current tournament that doesn't work. I think FIFA have acknowledged that it doesn't work as a competition because the European teams midst of their season. If you've won the Champions League, you can make a little bit of space in the calendar, but you can't really do a proper tournament in this time. So it's going to be revamped. So it's going to be revamped in 2025 from mid-June to mid-July. The United States is going to host the 2025 expanded edition, which will then be held every 4 years after that. The tournament is going to have eight groups of four, with the top two teams from each group going through to the knockout stages, basically a Club World Cup. There's going to be 12 teams from Europe, and South America will have six, while Africa, Asia, and North America are going to have four each. And there's various qualification measures, including did you win the Champions League in recent times and one or two others. But essentially, that is what you're looking at. There's going to be UEFA coefficients and things involved as well, which is painful to explain. Donny, what do you make to the fact we're going to be doing this expanded tournament? Because all the build-up to the games in Saudi Arabia going on right now, Bernardo Silva, I thought, gave a really interesting and eloquent interview about the fact that we weren't consulted on this. We don't want more games in June and July. I don't want to be involved in this. And, you know, great to be here. We don't have any say, but we're going to play it. I mean, did the calendar need this tournament? And if it does need this tournament, and I'm really open to the idea of all the confederations being involved in a tournament, maybe the winner of, you know, the CONCACAF, CONMEBOL, UEFA, Champions League versions coming together and doing a tournament of some ilk. I think there's some interest in that. But is there a necessity beyond money for this to happen? And I don't know, are you excited about it? Do you feel a sense of enthusiasm about it? Where are you with the expanded four-yearly, for now, Club World Cup?
So full disclosure, I used to call the Club World Cup for Fox Soccer Channel back in the day. So I was invested in it because financially I was calling games.
Yeah.
I watched last year when Seattle Sounders were involved because MLS. I don't even know what channel this tournament is on. I don't even know how to watch it. That's how little interest I have in it. I mean, literally, I'm watching tweets come in, and I saw the picture of, I totally forgot that Man City was leaving after the game and flying to Saudi Arabia. I saw Kevin De Bruyne is training in Saudi Arabia with Man City. I was like, oh, great. That's awesome. Wait, what? Oh yeah. FIFA Club World Cup. Zero. I saw Marcelo drew a penalty and did a little nutmegs. Nuts. I'm indifferent. I'm not going to go out of my way to try to find this game.
Because of when it is, though? Because we're in the midst of the European football season. You've just finished MLS, and we're at a point where there's so much football right now to focus on. There's like seven European leagues that are really interesting. We just had MLS Cup final. All this stuff is happening. If this was in June, when the European football season goes flat, and it's not in a tournament summer, do you think you'd have more interest then?
Potentially. Yeah, potentially I could. I mean, I do find it interesting. Listen, historically, Charles Celentano and company have brought massive teams over to the United States. Early in preseason, usually watered down because of international duty coming off whatever, either World Cup or whatever. But the ability to monetize credit cards, right? to dig into the Americana and to get the eyeballs and to get those purchases of jerseys and game tickets and all of that stuff. The AC Milans, the Juves, the Barcelonas, the Manchester United's, Man City's, the Chelsea's, all of those, Real Madrid, Barcelona, every summer in the United States, you know they're coming. You know there's going to be a trip. You know you're going to overpay for the tickets. You know you're probably not going to see all of your favorite players. But in the United States, it's a lot cheaper than going to Europe, right? So you finally get the opportunity to fly down to Santa Clara to watch Barcelona take on Manchester United for $200 a pop. I get all that. Leagues Cup was a part of figuring out how to, you know, claw into that marketing space between Major League Soccer and Liga MX.
Which worked pretty well. It was a good tournament.
Yeah, no, it worked well. You're going to have the Euros. You're going to have the Gold Cup. You have a lot of stuff crisscrossing, overlapping. The summer's extraordinarily busy. For me, I would watch a tournament, and I guess the way this is going to be planned, I would be intrigued to see some of these powerhouse clubs take on each other. Because what especially being in the United States, I'm really intrigued to see the adaption or the lack thereof from European teams with weather concerns and travel concerns, and understanding that, you know, if you're going to play one game in New York and you're going to play one game in Houston, you're going to one game in LA, that's three time zones, three significant different locales in terms of weather, as well as that's a lot of flying. It's not like getting on a bus and going to Liverpool 30 miles away if you're a Man United team. So, yeah, and the iconic kind of visuals of, you know, say theoretically, like a Boca Juniors could play like a Real Madrid, something like that. I think that would be fun just to kind of like roll back the clock in my mind, but to see the logos, see the colorway, see the jerseys. But ultimately, what does it mean? Nothing. Nothing. The king of all kings is Champions League. It's the one thing that Major League Soccer can never compete with. It's the one thing that Mexico can never compete with. South America can't compete with. Saudi Arabia can't compete with. That's the pinnacle. That is the success of domestic football, is being in Europe. So the rest of this, you're cha-ching, that's it.
Well, cha-ching. I mean, part of the cha-ching element is Arsene Wenger is now the FIFA Chief of Global Development. And he says, quote, it's a chance for other clubs to progress. He's also, of course, previously wanted to... Let me just read you a bit more of this. And I think what he means is, so his quote is, the positive impact this will have on clubs going is going to be huge because it will increase resources for clubs all over the world to develop and compete. So in this kind of egalitarian view of it, the idea would be that, who's in it? Palmeiras will make a bunch of money because they'll be in a group with Real Madrid and Man City, and those games will bring revenue in. You know, here's stage one, blank revenue for Palmeiras. You know, the middle bit is obviously UEFA and FIFA and all the other confederations taking the cash for themselves. But look, I suppose an egalitarian worldview would be, if we do this tournament, then how about we spread the money equally amongst these teams, or those that are poorer get all the money, and if you're owned by a country, you get none of the money. If that's the case, I'm actually slightly more for it. If all the money goes to the poorer confederations and UEFA make no money out of it, nor do their teams, yeah, okay, I can see that, but that's going to have no appeal for UEFA, and certainly no appeal to the individual clubs who are going to be in it, who will want whatever prize and revenue share they are owed. So the kind of typical FIFA, like, you know, we play the game sloganeering, but in the end, what's going to happen is it's going to be a cash grab by executives and confederations and a wonderful 30-day stay in a 10-star hotel for Arsene Wenger and Gianni Infantino and all these guys that are now just in it for the lifestyle, and that's sort of it. I mean, you're asking Man City or whatever, and I don't have a sympathy for Man City here, but let's say they win the Premier League on the, whatever it'll be, 25th of May. Then they win the Champions League on the 30th of May. You're asking them to fly to America and be at a group stage of a new tournament on June 13th. Like, they aren't going to give a solitary shit, and why would they, about this tournament? And you might say, oh, the prize money. They're owned by a country. Like, when Man City send their youth team to this tournament, I wonder what happens then.
I just, listen, we're all compromised. We're all compromised. Every single one of us are compromised, right? None of us are out here saying completely and fully what we think, because we always have to hold just a little bit back based on who our employers are. And what I find is fascinating right now is that Arsene Wenger 20 years ago was talking about the complications of the schedule as it was all the way back then, talking about the need for national team managers to have a better understanding of what it meant to be a domestic manager in club football. And was it worth taking my player for such a worthless international friendly when he could have been okay? And we weren't vilifying injuries the way that injuries were being vilified back then. Listen, Arsene Wenger, I think, has done an incredible job for the game, and can talk about whether the influence with IFAB, which I think at some points has been pretty positive, the influence with VAR, being a football man in a football room, I think is a positive in a lot of ways, having somebody that can push back. But at the same time, just to say that, well, hold on, VAR is there to protect the players. Think about where nutrition and supplements and player protection and strength and conditioning and the use of technology, that's how players play more games. That's how guys like Benzema and Ronaldo and Messi can play until they're 35. Yeah, all of that's well and good. But we also saw transformative moments where players started thinking about their diet, where they weren't going out to the pub and having a beer after the game, where they weren't going to McDonald's after a game because of the money that they were making, that they could have Phil Foden could be 19 years old and have a private chef instead of, you know, for me, making a bag of oatmeal before I went to training. As soon as I got done, chugging a water and getting the hell out of there because I was starving, that I had to go home and make myself peanut butter and jellies because I was on $776.78 every 2 weeks living in Boston. And my mortgage, or my house was, my apartment was $1,000. I mean, the reality is that it's all about the money. I get that we all want high-level competition, but we're really not so far out of the neighborhood of the Super League talk. We really aren't. We're talking about different dynamics. We're talking about different tournaments. You and I are as I think culpable in some ways of talking about, well, it was in COVID. Throw it against the wall. See what sticks. See if we can revamp. Hey, look what's happening in Champions League. Do we have to be home and away? Can it just be in a tournament format? Oh my God. Well, COVID, we have to do that because it's Lisbon and this is what's going to happen. And this is what it looks. So all of a sudden it's like, how do we make games more important? How do we monetize better? How can we create bigger, brighter, better game? How can we find a better wheel? All of these things. But this, We're starting to monetize the sanctity of football. And maybe we already have. Maybe that ship has left the port a long time ago. But this is not about the players. This isn't about the players. It doesn't necessarily have to be about the players, but you should be thinking about the players' safety and welfare. And what we've been talking about the past 2 weeks, oh my God, these injuries. Oh my God, these injuries. Have you seen Chelsea? Have you seen Manchester United? What the hell is happening? What's going on? How are these players? Yeah, I'm not, as of right now, that interested. There's nothing that's like pulling me towards this. My biggest question is, when we're talking about the amount of money that it's going to bring, it's the same conversation I have with the expansion of FIFA and the World Cup. Prove to me where that money's going. If you're going to tell me this is going to generate so much money and it's going to make so much money for Palmeiras, it's going to make so much money for insert name here, Trinidad Tobago. Like, where's that money going? How much of that money's going? Do a better job verbalizing and showcasing and publicizing where this expanded formats and creation of tournaments that's going to generate all of this money for the lowest form of football across the world and create this infrastructure that'll make us infinitely better. Prove it. Where are we seeing it? Because I certainly am not seeing it.
But we are seeing Gianni Infantino in hotels made exclusively of marble, drinking champagne on a constant basis. And that's kind of what we don't want to say, you know. Look, we're out of time. It's a shame that Arsene Wenger forgot he invented the term the red zone and now wants more tournaments. But there you go. What's happened to him, I do not know. But player welfare certainly isn't high on the agenda in this particular tournament. And, you know, for what it's worth, I'll write the calendar for you. I'll write the calendar for you and I'll make sure all the players get enough time off in between games. I'll still give you all the games that you want. Make the calendar make sense. Give them all plenty of time off. It can be done, You just don't want to do it because if you see a day off, you think, is there any chance Chelsea can play there? And that's the problem. Danny, happy Christmas, mate. Have a wonderful time.
I hope so.
Yeah, hope so. Good luck.
Yeah, you too.
I'll also try and have a nice Christmas in amongst, you know, shifts. Next week is Boxing Day, the Victorian holiday, the day after Christmas, where rich English people give boxes of presents to peasants. It's a bank holiday in England, so I'll be at work for like 15 hours Boxing Day because literally everyone else is seeing their family and friends. So no recording next Tuesday. We're looking at getting a show in next Friday after we've had this whole ludicrous three rounds of Premier League games. So we'll see you then. Brian Dunseth, that's him over there. I'm Tom Rennie. Tim Horsey produced the program. It's called Week in the Tackle. It's a podcast. You can watch it on YouTube right now. Subscribe today and watch in full. And if you're watching on YouTube, hello, it's also a podcast. So subscribe and listen at your leisure. Happy Christmas.